You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
Obviously, off the back of that very difficult middle hour story that you heard there of a former director at Grant Thornton South Africa narrating their experience of sexual harassment, we thought we should put together a panel, and we've done exactly that. We've also, from a point of view of journalistic process and ethics, reached out to the company. They did listen to that hour. We'll send them the podcast as well, and then we will see how they will respond. Obviously, they have a right of reply, and we're happy to offer them that. But joining me now, on the line, I've got Lisa Vetten, who's a senior researcher at WITS, specializing in gender violence. Lisa, good morning to you, and thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, CBS, and good morning to your listeners.
Also on is Natasha Moni. Natasha, of course, is a labor specialist, director at Moni's Attorney Incorporated. Good morning, Natasha, and welcome to this panel.
Thank you very much, CBS. Glad to be here.
And then I've got two guests here in the studio with me, Faith Daniels from Kagiso Media. Good morning, Faith. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, you CBS.
And the CEO of Soul City Institute, social activist and feminist, Lebo Ramafoko, who's also here with us. Lebo, it's always wonderful having you on the show.
Thank you for having me,
I really don't know where to start, Faith. Let me pick on you because I know you, I know all of you, but I know you're the most, like, I mean, what came up for you when you heard that audio? And then we'll segue into, I suppose, the structural issues.
Look, you know what, for me, I mean, I just say to you now that it was my second time listening to it. And I don't know whether it was worse or, you know, what I don't know how to pinpoint everything that came up for me, because it's anger, because it's raw, and it's disgust, and it's just everything rolled into one. And for me, the thing is, the sad thing about this, Yusuf, is that experience, Narisha's experience, is not an isolated one at all. That is a South African woman's experience almost every single day. That entire story, parts of the story, three-thirds of the story, had to resonate with a lot of us. It resonated with me, you know? It made me think of, like, the awkward situations that I've been placed in, how I handled it, whether it was the right thing to speak out, whether it was what did I do? You know, it's so many questions and there's so many emotions. And I think that just the rawness of it, I mean, for me, like, as a journalist, as a woman, I just wanted to make her feel better. I don't know how you reach out to Narisha to say that you are, the speaking out, it's the right thing to do. Because sometimes you don't know if it's the right thing to do. Because look at our society and our reaction and how we treat women who speak out.
Absolutely.
You know, so you don't even know if saying to somebody, speaking out, I support you and that's the right thing to do. You don't know if that's the right thing to do, because look at where Jennifer Ferguson is, for instance, today. And look at how we react on social media and all platforms. Look at how we react to her.
And Lebo, we've got this weird idea that there is somehow a template for what it means to be a real victim of sexual harassment. If your CBS says, oh, Lebo, why are you still unmarried? Don't go to HR, man. Get sense of humor.
Yeah.
And when she talks about the first red flag, I thought to myself, you know what? Some people may not feel safe to perform their misogyny if I ask them to call in today. But the truth of the matter is that many people, including sadly some women, will listen and go, ah, but man, if a guy at work says to you, now that I've met your parents, maybe I can take you for a weekend. Ah, that's just like banter.
Yes, that's how men are. That's how men behave. And I think even the perpetrator thrives on that environment. He thrives on his position of power because of his level at work. He thrives on the position of power given by his gender, the fact that he's male, and the fact that what will happen. So we must recognize that these spaces are not pro-women, whether their sexual harassment happens or not. When you enter a workplace, largely, it is not a space that is pro-women. So the culture that thrives is that even the jokes we say to each other, even the way we can, the parts of women we can pet, even the way we can belittle women or talk to them, it's just how we do things. So how dare you even take the fact that I said to you, can I marry you,
as an insult.
You should be so flattered that a CEO of a company sees you worthy, you know, of being taken out or married or whatever the case is.
Absolutely.
And that is what patriarchy and misogyny looks like.
Absolutely.
Because often it's almost as if, and this is the sense that I got when I listened to the interview, when you basically speak about gender equity, the response you get, it's like, but women can now work. Women can now buy cars. Women can now own houses. Yeah. Women can do this.
And she's in the boardroom. She's in the leadership structure.
She is exactly there.
Yeah.
But is the culture a conducive one for both men and women? And in this case, it is not. Mm.
Lisa, one thing you said to my producer you want to do, which obviously is very important, is to, while not running away from corporate South Africa, is to situate this kind of story within the wider societal context.
Yes, very much so, because I think we've seen these outbreaks of scandal occurring in the university sector. People may remember the protests at Rhodes and at other universities in 2016. And I think our legislatures and our political parties have long been able to fly under the radar. And that's got a lot to do with the fact that we have weaknesses in legislation there, and there, of course, you are dealing with very interesting permutations around power and gender. So I think every so often it seems like our attention gets captured by a particular case, but we don't look at the broader systemic and structural problems, and our attention doesn't stay focused on them long enough for us to actually achieve change. We're outraged by the individual story, and then we move on to the next individual outrage, whatever that may be.
And at the same time, of course, Natasha, the power of the individual story is that sometimes there's a kind of emotional comfort for perpetrators when we talk in a slightly detached manner about the structural issues. So we've got to do both, right? I mean, we took the decision, for example, to tell the singular story of Nerissa, knowing that it is the story of many women, but unfortunately many people who lack empathy for survivors and victims of predation, for some people the wake-up moment is when they allow themselves to get into the full headspace of the single story.
The full headspace of the single story is great, and what I'm picking up is that the company knew before they had hired her about the predation and about the predator. And what the company, I believe, has done from hearing one side of the story is pay mere lip service to the code of good practice on the handling of sexual harassment cases in the Labor Relations Act. But there's no substance. And they try and mitigate their risk by throwing another woman at it. And we all know, in terms of the gender bias that there is, that women have a higher gender bias against other women. At 42%.
Wow.
So all in all, what I see in this matter is that what has happened to this woman has constituted a barrier to equity in the workplace. And it is enormously serious. If a woman who is so highly skilled and highly qualified and so highly competent cannot break through and in an environment and feel safe, we've got a very serious problem on our hands, and I'd like to ask if you agree with me. I believe that Johannesburg is possibly the sexual harassment capital of the world.
I think South Africa is the sexual harassment capital of the world, period. Because young girls in schools will tell you of teachers behaving this way. So, and I liked what Lisa is saying about the broader societal context. You know, the Rhodes University reference list was in a university in the Eastern Cape. I think we are really talking about a societal factor that views women largely, black, white, short, tall, in whatever way. Professional unemployed, in any way as first sexual objects for the satisfaction of men. And in fact, it seems in the social context that you need to be grateful when these things don't happen to you, or when they happen, you need to be grateful that, you know, you were not raped. Oh, at least he did not, you know, it was that hug, but he did not pin her against the wall and rape her, you know, and that is the narrative, because for so long, we have allowed this behavior to go completely unpunished. And while I agree with Lisa, I personally feel as a social activist that every story, particularly when somebody has the bravery of speaking out, deserves us to talk about it. I wish this show was 3 hours for us to talk about it and really show our disdain at the structural issues that are happening to women.
You know, the second time I listened to a story, Faith, last night, I thought to myself, the one thing there were two lines that jumped out at me the second time I heard it. The first line was when she says, when he gave her the necklace, what was uncomfortable about that was not just the fact that this was an attempt at grooming, but also, she then says, I realized that he has been looking at me intimately at my neck and my body, and I found that chilling.
Yes.
The second was when she then talks about the point at which she just had to resign. She said, and then the lawyer in her comes out, but the human part of the story can't be lost on anyone who listens as a mensch when she says, my resignation was accepted by the perpetrator.
Yes, yes,
yes.
And what does that say about the spaces, right? You see, Biz, that we as women, we are in these spaces, we run these spaces, we have leadership positions in these spaces. But what does it say about the patriarchy and how that operates, right? The fact that you can be whoever you want to be, you are female, but we run the space, right? And we dictate to you what you do and how you're going to do it. And if you want to go because you want to whine and whinge, then go. Mm. Let me tell you, you see, Biz, after I spoke to the second woman who came forward, right, who told her story to me about Danny Jordan and violating her, right, I opened it up and I made a point of it to speak to other women and wider than just the media organizations, people whom I knew and my wider circle. And the conversations that we had, it told me, because it's Narisha's story, right? And what we all had in common in that conversations were the fact that nobody spoke out. Because in your head, right, the first thing we do is you doubt yourself, right? Because you go through that conversations and you think, did I read this wrong? That weekend that he said that, like, he offered me to go away, what could that possibly be? Surely he didn't mean that. What does that mean?
Yeah.
You know, does he want to have sex with me? Does he want to have a relationship with me? I don't understand, because, like, this is a work situation. Did I lead him on? What did I do?
Yes.
Right? And in a large majority of the conversation that I had with my friends and the women that I know in the media industry and wider, we've all had similar and worse experiences. And what we have in common is the silence, because we doubt ourselves, right?
That sounds to me almost like, and that's real, I mean, that's harrowing, right? Because it sounds to me like you put your own behavior on trial. You almost, in the first sentence, you name the perpetrator, but then you immediately decenter him and you center yourself.
Yeah, yes. That
because
is so
you know
true.
What? So you're in the work situation and you're working with people, you interacting with people, you're networking with people, right? And you are there purely for business. You are there to serve a purpose. You understand what you are doing.
Yeah.
When that comes to you at a certain angle, right? And all of a sudden, a comment makes you feel uncomfortable, right? It's not overt. He didn't touch you, right? He didn't shake you. He didn't slap you, right? Inappropriately. He made a comment. And you catch yourself feeling a certain way, right? And immediately, what I found in my conversations is that the first reaction of, and I've done it myself, you think, okay, wait, what was that, right? Yeah. Maybe I read it wrong. Surely he couldn't. And, you know, so you start to doubt yourself. Mm-hmm. And then lies the problem.
Absolutely.
The fact that I don't think we speak about this enough, so that the women around us and the women who listen to 702, the women who listen to our conversations, can understand that it's okay to speak out. Mm-hmm. That the doubt sets in, but you're not wrong.
Absolutely. Mm. I wanted to take a break there. There's a legal aspect to this conversation and a social aspect, Lebo. Mm. On the other side of this break, Natasha, I want you to help us out just with the legal aspect first. Mm-hmm. What in law counts as sexual harassment? I know there will be countless people, and I want to speak on their behalf, and I don't legitimate their ignorance or even their willful ignorance, who will say, but that first red flag wasn't sexual harassment. If I say, Natasha, I'd love to go to Port Alfred for the weekend with you, that is not sexual harassment. Maybe by the time I buy you jewelry, some people will say, okay, now we're getting there. And even then some will say it's not. So what in law is sexual harassment? We're going to tackle that question on the other side of this break.
This experience.
Eusebius Makaiser on 702 and Cape Talk.
We have a panel and we're talking about violence against women in society. Faith Daniels is with us, a journalist, Lebo Ramofoko, who's with Soul City Institute, Lisa Vetten, researcher and academic and activist on gender violence, and of course also labor specialist, Natasha Moni. Natasha, I want to go back to you. What is the test in law for sexual harassment?
You find it in the Code of Good Practice on the handling of sexual harassment cases. I think that's the easiest way to find it. And the law says that sexual harassment is not permitted or condoned, and the duty to ensure this is the management's. And it is defined as unwanted conduct of a sexual nature. But I also like to put in unwelcome and unwarranted. This means that the attention that a recipient is getting becomes harassment when it persists. The recipient must set their boundaries, and the law seems to be a little archaic in that respect, but your labor law and the case law precedent that is coming out in that respect is filling meat on the bone. So there's now a broader meaning and a wider meaning to setting your boundaries. And then what is most interesting to me, and people sometimes forget this, especially recipients, is that the perpetrator should have known that the behavior is unacceptable. So what, and that is for me an objective test. The forms of sexual harassment are physical, verbal, nonverbal, quid pro quo, sexual favoritism, and grooming. And I'm glad you brought that up, because grooming is rather new, and you don't expect grooming to happen in the workplace, but it's becoming more and more prevalent. You see, yes, I'd like to get back to you. The employer allowed the perpetrator to resign.
Yes,
and
yes.
For me, this is...
Yes, that was going to be my next question, is what duties fall on them legally? They obviously have ethical duties. They can't escape the ethical skewering. But besides the ethical question, what ought they to have done in terms of providing a workplace that is safe?
Again, there's a procedure there that the Code of Good Practice sets out. And it says, appoint an outside person to whom employees can confide, and an HR department simply does not do any longer. I have seen HR departments become complicit in sexual harassment complaints. They are no longer a valuable tool to go and complain. They assist the company to neutralize what they believe a sexual harassment complaint is. They see it as a threat. And you can resolve matters in two ways. You can resolve matters either informally or you can do so formally. It is the recipient's choice. It cannot be anybody else's choice. It cannot be the company's choice. The resignation was what was absolutely horrifying in my mind. And without that resignation, what the company was able to do is to get him to hear what he had done and to allow her healing.
Yeah.
And they denied her this. And they shouldn't have, because when an employee resigns, an employee has to work their notice period. And it's normally when the employees are working their notice periods that you can run a disciplinary inquiry. You can run the processes. But somehow they allowed him to walk away. What happened? He walked away scot-free.
Absolutely. Lisa, how do we even begin to think about this as at a systemic level? Because, as I said to Narisha herself yesterday, the law is an important instrument, sometimes not for justice, but something that I didn't recognize until Shahida Omar talked to me about children who often have to testify, and where they do good preparatory work with children, telling them why it is that you might have the perpetrator not found guilty in law, and they prep them for that process, but they still have the children go through the court process, because sometimes you can get a little bit of healing even if you don't get justice. But the point that I'm trying to make is that rape and sexual harassment is so insidious in our society that a top-down legalistic approach, because the law in South Africa is inherently by design adversarial, it will never transform society.
It really depends, Eusebius, and I think workplaces and universities have far more leeway than the criminal courts.
Mm.
And this they forget, and I think they forget willfully,
okay,
is that firstly, this is a civil procedure, and you can design it in a way that is inquisitorial.
Mm.
So, I mean, just to explain to people the difference, an adversarial process does really pit one person against the other. Mm. It's how do we test the story. It's a combat.
Yeah.
Who's going to emerge victorious? Whereas an inquisitorial process cuts out that kind of verbal hand-to-hand combat, for want of a better way of putting it,
yeah,
and is much more inquiring. The leader of your inquiry will do most of the questioning, and that will often reduce the hostile nature of cross-examination, for example.
Mm.
So I think companies and universities and colleges can do far better, and they can think much more imaginatively in terms of the sorts of processes that they run, because they don't need to be damaging. You can design them in ways that are much more helpful.
Mm.
You know, you can do things like allow somebody to bring a support person with them to accompany them through the hearing, for instance.
But of course, what's interesting, right? I mean, take the case of Jennifer Ferguson, who's now laid a rape charge. She reached out to Danny Yordan, mm, wanting to have what she calls a TRC-like restorative justice process, mm, Faith. And in his case, there was a tactical decision obviously taken by him and the lawyer, and they did it under the pretext that actually we're brave enough to go through an adversarial process. We don't want to be seen to be secretly conceding that the guy is guilty by having this TRC restorative justice process behind cloak and daggers. Bring it on.
Yeah.
And that sounds like someone who's innocent, but to me it also sounds like someone who knows that an adversarial process invariably favors the perpetrator.
Exactly, because we're talking about a crime that was committed 24 years ago, right? Mm. I mean, obviously, everybody knows. How are you going to test that, right? It is a he said, she said situation. Mm. What was really heartening for me now in the where Jennifer Ferguson is with her story is the fact that when she spoke to you, UCBS, yesterday, and she spoke about the process, right, going to the police station and laying the charge, mm, and just the policeman not even understanding what she is actually there to do and,
yeah,
why she wants to do it, right? For me, yeah, the heartening thing was that she had support, and that when she speaks about the rape incident 24 years ago, she says, you know, I didn't have the support. I got up from that, mm, that terrible experience, and I had nobody to turn to, mm, right? Now, for me, I mean, when we talk about support, that is exactly what is lacking, mm, in this entire debate that we are talking about. Whether it's the start process, right?
Mm.
Whether it's this thing has just happened, or I need to speak to somebody in the middle of this process, I need a soundboard, I need guidance, or whatever it is, because the justice system is so, it is a quagmire to just navigate.
Absolutely.
People don't know exactly what they need to do. They don't even have like the support of just saying to somebody, this just happened to me, what do I do?
Absolutely.
Right? And for me, the Jennifer Ferguson story now, that is the heartening thing for me, is, mm, that she had the support system. Even though she said to you it was a man. And then I turned to this man to speak to the policeman,
mm-hmm,
because it was just easier,
mm-hmm,
because he just didn't get what I was doing,
mm-hmm,
you know, and, mm-hmm, why I wanted to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to turn to this man just to help, mm-hmm, me, you,
absolutely,
know. And for,
absolutely,
me, that's, it's a tragedy also,
absolutely,
that we are at this stage where we can't tell our own stories. We can't be the narrators of our own experiences,
mm-hmm,
right? Because wherever we go into this male situations, these male institutions where we seek help,
mm,
and,
yep,
where we need help,
mm,
you almost need a male interpreter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's back to the old era of, which has never gone away, so we shouldn't call it old, of a presumption of lack of credibility as a witness.
Yeah.
Eusebius Mackayser on your number one news and talk station.
Yeah. Lebo, I want us to pick up on Faith's point, because this is also a point that Faith made to me the other day when her and I dialogued about this issue, this question of believability.
Mm.
I don't know, is the answer obvious? Why is it that society struggles to believe women the first time? You either need, like Jennifer Ferguson was asked by this police officer last week, where's your medical records?
Mm.
Or you need desperately to wait for a second or third woman to come on. Narisha Singh must be so relieved that two women called in during the hour, because now there's a pattern. I mean, why do we need to resort to this kind of scientific standard before a woman can be believed?
We live in a patriarchal society. Mm. Patriarchy is about power. And there are so many institutions and systems and social norms that do not want to upset the apple cart. So other people, even when they will not pin you against the wall and rape you, are perpetrators in the sense that they want to keep the status quo. And one of the ways that you keep the status quo is you support, even at an unconscious level, some social norms that just keeps the power like that. Mm. So, interestingly, I had to report a rape very recently that had happened in my own house, of somebody who was in my house. The first thing the policeman that came in said is that it's now difficult for us, you know. You don't know whether, even if you were driving at night, whether you must give a woman a lift. So for me, that guy may as well as have raped a woman, because all of a sudden, what is he being confronted with is the fact that if we allow these women to become as nonsensical as they are, we may be upsetting the apple cart. Yeah. So patriarchy has a way of reinventing itself and propping itself up. That is why before we really can believe that Lebo was raped, okay, she's not 6 months old, so maybe it wasn't raped. She slept with a man. We even have evidence that she says she enjoys sex. So no, that's not the case. You know, so leave our status quo as it is. And we inhabit a world as women, regardless of how good or not the laws are, where on a daily basis you are reminded, this is how the world is.
Yeah.
And please do not upset the apple cart.
Yeah.
And whether you are a Jennifer Ferguson, or you are a student at Rhodes, or you are a comrade who has been toying with your fellow comrades against fees, but all of a sudden you are calling them out on your misogyny, somebody's like, you are now coloring out of the line. You know, you can question this side of the line.
Yeah.
But when you get that side,
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Remember,
let's go to Mama's
you are
career.
Being a nuisance.
Mika, thank you for holding on.
Hi, Eusebius. Thank you for taking my call. I actually had a very interesting case yesterday. I am involved in labor law myself. And I have a case of sexual harassment. Let's call it the alleged perpetrator making a comment. And because I only have about a year's experience in this, I went to one of my my team leader, and he just mentioned to me, remember, he didn't actually touch her. He just made a comment. So should we really actually dismiss him? And I just it just gave me pause thinking about sexual harassment is sexual harassment, whether you touched or not.
Yeah.
The woman, the victim was extremely upset about this.
Yeah.
And what makes it even worse is that when he was notified of the fact that she was so upset about this, he went to most of the colleagues and made an absolute joke about this, to an extent that he makes jokes about, oh, now I'm not allowed to talk to you anymore because I might have a case of sexual harassment against me. What is more, when I did research on this, it seems that unless you have a sexual harassment policy, your hands are tied. And I was just wondering whether that is actually true, whether you need a policy in order to act against perpetrators.
That's a very good question. I'll get Natasha to answer in a second. John in Edenvale, welcome.
Good day, Vicious. How are you? I've got one small problem. We're all talking about the sexual harassment, but then you get one of our ex-leaders rape someone, and everyone spends millions of rands to keep him out of jail. And the Women's League says he never did it, and everyone said he never did it. And unless we change the ethics from the top, we will not change what's happening on ground.
Okay, John, we're going to come to your comment in a second as well. Let's first deal with Mika's one, if we can, quickly, Natasha. Do I need to have a policy written in the reception area of Prime Media before legal duties arise institutionally?
No, absolutely not. And please remember that ignorance of the law is no defense. And it shouldn't be a defense to people who are directors of boards of companies. There is the Code of Good Practice on the Handling of Sexual Harassment, which says confidentiality is key. You cannot go after the victim. And if you are doing that, that is a dismissible offense. And I think that it's about time that the chairpersons of inquiries and those people who are giving advice, good legal advice, should always preface it with, this is very serious. And you have to stop this rot. You see, if I can also come in there, I think it's very important that we make it clear that companies who know about sexual harassment and fail to take action are themselves open to claims, vicarious liability. Yes. So, for example, the fact that when Narisha was speaking, another two women came in and that she also had the experience of saying, we went and we complained about this man. That suggests that the company knew and failed to take action.
Yeah.
So the action would now not only be against that individual, but against the company as well. Mm. I think it's very important that people are aware of that. And it's even more of an incentive for companies not to sweep things under the carpet, which is their preference, but to take firm and decisive action when something like this happens.
Lisa, I want you to also engage John's point, because I know that in your own writing and work, the political question is important. I both agree with John, but I also wish you would add something else on. I mean, obviously, if we look at the way Fezeka was vilified by everyone, so many people in this country in support of Jacob Zuma, we don't have in our politics any respect for dismantling patriarchy seriously, despite what the ANC professes. And yet at the same time, I think to myself, it happens at the top, but it also happens in our own locker rooms, in our own boardrooms, in our own institutions. And it's not to say that John first needs to fess up to his own behavior or his peers, wherever he might be working, before he's right to point out the lack of political leadership. But it's everywhere, isn't it?
It is, and I think the problem he's pointing to is the fact that we get very mixed messages. So on the one hand, you get told, don't do this, but it's okay if I do it. So, you know, don't... I'm allowed to behave like this, but you not. And I think that sends a very inconsistent message, and it says to people, well, actually, whether or not there are consequences really depends on who you are, who your friends are, and how they can cover you. So I think he's pointing to a broader problem. Mm. Obviously, politics, because of the role of the leadership that it plays, is one where we particularly look very carefully at what is being modeled there. Mm. And if we're seeing something corrupt going on there, then the question we want to ask ourselves, well, isn't that hypocritical, and why should I be held to standards that somebody else is not being held to? So he's using an example in politics, but I mean, you can use it in a workplace, is to pick on the lower level workers and make sure that they get booted out for sexual harassment, but you ensure that leadership is never touched.
Yeah.
So I think what he's asking for is the need to be consistent.
Yeah, absolutely. Faith, I want you to share something that you shared with me the other day on the phone, which is, although women are not believed everywhere, there are also historic facts about our South African history and society that compounds this without legitimizing people not believing you.
Of course. I mean, like, you only have to look at the hashtag MeToo campaign, right? Mm. And how women around the world have reacted to this, right? And you ask the question, but so what's happening here, right? Because you see instances where women participate, you see it here and there, you see a sprinkle of women supporting that particular woman telling her story, but why is it that it's not such a big phenomenon here? Mm. And the reason is And the reason is, I believe that we are so completely different in terms of our patriarchy, in terms of where we come from, right? In terms of our past and how we are now, as women, dealing with these women in the workplace, leadership roles, all of these things, it's fairly new for us, right? So we're grappling with not just being women in these different spaces, but we're grappling with, like, so who am I in these spaces, right?
And the other thing, of course, and I just want to trigger your memory here, is you said to me something along the lines of how in our particular society, for example, 80s, 70s, I mean, even when we were growing up, this was still going on. Who's MPMP? Who can I trust? There's a whole culture linked to our history of fighting colonialism and apartheid that instills in us mistrust.
I mean, and that is our history, and we can't shy away from it. I mean, even with us, you see, growing up, you know, when your parents said to you that you should not be heard, right? You should be seen and not heard, right? And you will speak when I tell you to speak, right? And grown-ups should always be respected. And, you know, so all of these things. So we grow up in a society which is fractured. We have a particular history. I mean, it's no mistake that Jennifer Ferguson points to the TRC, right?
Sure.
Because that's a part of healing that she clings to. That's what she wants. Mm. You know, that's what she wants. She wants Danny O'Dan to be honest about what has happened. So not just for her, to heal, but for him to heal as well. That is what she wants. The TRC is our experience, and she's clinging to that because that is the type of truth and healing that she
specific
wants.
Specific to our, you know, experience.
So
yeah,
for our, we have particular instances in history, right, that makes it particularly difficult for us to grapple through this. But we have to. And your caller, I mean, when he says that, like, we must look to government, he's not wrong. We must, because the leadership and the moral leadership must come from them. They must point us to a particular direction.
Absolutely.
And what does it say to us, Eusebius, when we have a ministry of women, right, that on International Women's Day does not have a particular message to the women of this country? It's not like we're not hurting.
That's right.
It's not like our country loves us. I mean, you ended your conversation with Naresha to say that this is not a country for women. And it's true, and it's not to be taken lightly. And we must have those type of conversations, but I think that, like, the more important thing is that we must have the conversations with men, you know? We must have the conversations with men to say, why is it that the hashtag men are trash hashtag is still trending? Why is it that we're not letting go of it? Why is it that every time you're on social media and you're defending it, we drag you?
And why
we take you down? Why
are you more likely to call into a talk radio station to express a viewpoint on men are trash, but you are less likely to call in to react to Naresha Singh's story?
No, exactly. Absolutely.
Let's take a couple of calls. This will be the last calls we'll take because, as you can see, my panel is brilliant and I want to give them each another bite at the cherry. Defamelo, thank you for your patience, however. What do you want to contribute to this discussion?
Hi. You know, you say this. I just wanted to speak about what I'm quite familiar with and what I really refer to as economic rape. You know, sometimes when you are employed, maybe there's HR, which is useless. Maybe there are other factors. But, you know, women in business that are bullied by corporates, you know, white males, only because they can. You know, where do they cry? Who listens to them? Because, you know, people that are really, you know, businesses are taken away. Only because, you know what, when you look around, there's like really no particular reason. It's only because this corporate can do it. And, you know, in a way, we are prejudiced, I think, as female in so many instances. And the reason why I call it economic rape is because of the violation I feel, because of the helplessness. There's no one to tell, you know, to help me. There's no one for me to go out. And when you do speak to colleagues and everyone, and people say, oh, man, just talk to him. He will understand. Just talk to him. You know, he will understand. No, he is not going to understand.
Yeah.
And so I'm just finding that there is no voice speaking to those women in business who are shocked by corporate.
Absolutely.
So bullied, because you know what? We do not have the legal fees. There is nowhere to go.
Sure. Thank you, Defamelo. We're going to come to that on the other side of the break. Is it Tam or Tam?
Hi.
Hi, welcome.
I would just like to find out, I'm actually busy with a case at this stage, and I'd like to know what is the process or how does the prosecutor supposed to help a little child that's going through a sexual assault case currently?
Okay, that's a big question. I'm not sure whether we'll be able to unravel all of the answers to that one yet, Tom. But I promise you we'll put that on our list of things to bring some show content to answer and empower people in situations like yours. We'll take a break here, and we're going to wrap with our panel on the other side of this, including specifically talking about attitudes towards women that are perceived to be powerful.
Eusebius McKaiser on 702 and Cape Talk.
Thank you.
All predation is obviously both unlawful and immoral, but there are particularities depending on how different parts of your identity intersect. In other words, class differences, geographical differences, etc., etc., differences of place of origin. That last caller was speaking, Lebo in particular, about being perceived as a powerful woman, a woman in business. Are there particularities to that class of women that we also need to highlight? Which is not to say we're trying to play an Olympics of suffering here.
In a lot of ways, it seems as if the price is higher. Because, in fact, even when you are facing domestic abuse, the issue is, what is the price of me as a CEO speaking out about this? Because the perception out there is, one, I should know better. Two, my life is flawless. Three, I'm most probably bringing down a powerful man. And do I really? So you are calculating. you know, your own abuse and experience becomes almost a barter that mm-hmm. you have around, do I really want to be the CEO that is known as the woman that was abused? Because in fact, what society tells you about achieving some social status is that you've got your things figured out.
Mm-hmm.
And abuse does seem, particularly because of how society is going to react, does seem like it is a blemish against this very, you know, clean slate that you've got, this perfect trajectory and this perfect story of ascending up. So even if it was a domestic abuse case, it's like, what will people say? She is the CEO, but look at the mess that is happening in her house.
Mm.
Or at work, you know, what are people going to say? She is disloyal and she wants to bring a powerful man down. So it is almost as if you've got so much more to lose when you are in a particular position. And it's very interesting that in the story we listened to, you know, what for me got to me was, these are my skills. And after I had spoken out, a junior white male with no qualifications was basically brought in and I had to report to him.
Mm.
So the point is saying, black woman, know your place. You may have your qualifications, but in this place, you are a second-class citizen. And even as we ascend this corporate ladder, we do know that in the broader scheme of things, unless you work hard, and even after you have done that, there is always something lacking in the background to show you your place. And you make those calculations when you dare color outside of the line to say, where is that big ruler that is going to be hitting my head and saying, know your place?
Faith, does it, in addition to what Lebo was saying, is there anything interesting to be observed or not about the fact that in Arisha's story, the deputy CEO of the company is a woman?
Mm-hmm. And I want to pick up on what Lisa said earlier, that it's almost in certain instances, it makes it worse, yeah. Right? Because they send in a woman or a woman fronts that so that you guys can have the standoff and we all participate in just looking on.
Yeah.
Right? But what I wanted also to say about in reaction to Lebo, it's not just about black women know your place. It's if we perpetually have these conversations without changing the status quo, it's going to be perpetually black women, you are on your own.
Yeah.
Because this is true. How we feel in our own that's country. Right? And true. Our feelings are valid. And if we don't have these conversations that puts it in context, but where men tell us, what is your place in this discussion? What are you going to do about this as well? And stop defending hashtag men are trash and stop explaining to me why you are not trash, why it's isolated incidences and why you are not part of it. You are. You must defend your gender. You must aid. You must help us get other men on board in terms of changing the status quo. Otherwise, it's going to be perpetually black women, you are on your own.
Lisa, I'm going to give you the last word in 1 minute. I want you to just respond to something that Faith said before the last break. What conversations, she asked, as a woman, should we be having with men? How should men enter this conversation? Should I have an all-male panel? A mixed gender panel? What should a different version of this conversation look like where you as a woman are given a break?
I think a mixed gender panel would probably be more useful in terms of being able to challenge and engage on these issues. But I would actually encourage every workplace to be having those kinds of conversations. We spend so much time at work every day that I think a key part of what we need to be doing in workplaces is to sit down and say, what is the kind of environment that we want? How do we make it welcoming and inviting?
Yeah.
And that would, I think, be just as much, that would be as useful where you are based as national conversations or radio interviews.
Okay. Lisa, I want to thank you so much for coming on. Natasha, thank you for your excellent work and guidance on both the legal and social issues. And the same to both of you, Faith and Labour, and especially for coming into the studio. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.